This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. Like I'm sure a lot of people, maybe most people over the last 4 months, I have felt increasingly crazy, psychotic, meaning detached from a reality that many other people seem to share. I am not living in the same world, it seems often, as most other Americans. My guest this week convinced me, I think, that that's a good thing. I'm very glad to have back on the show my very good friend who now lives very far away. This is my interview with Connor Habib. I am joined by Connor Habib, good friend I haven't seen in a long time. He's very far away. He's in a place I've always wanted to visit. When I lived in London for a year during college, I did not go there, and I am still pissed at myself for that. But someday maybe I'll visit you. Connor, you're in Dublin.
I'm in Dublin. Yes. It's great.
that's what you keep saying. I've been following you on Twitter, and we've talked a bit by text and stuff, but it seems at times as if you have felt, well, you have felt solitude there, but you like that. Like I am averse generally to social isolation. This is why I dislike the quarantine intensely. It seems like you're much more fitted to that.
I am. I mean, I actually didn't know how much I was, and there certainly was like intense loneliness upon arriving, you know, and just not really knowing anybody. Just uprooted my life, and you know, I'm 42 now. And so it was just like, you know, pretty big shift. But now, you know, I have friends and I really like my time alone. And, you know, certainly during like lockdown, I was walking through Grafton Street, which is kind of the Disneyfied part of Dublin. It's like, it kind of sucks, but it's always really full. But during lockdown, it was just completely empty. And I just thought, oh gosh, like there's a part of me that was like, I just wish we were always like this, you know? Yeah. And then I realized I was ready for like true, like solitude and isolation in a much more remote part, but that's in the works. So Dublin for now. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, my like imaginings of Dublin and Ireland generally, based on like everything that Americans have told me who visit, it's as if it's like, it may be like the Chinese, you know, streets are paved with gold myth kind of thing. But like, for me, I imagine like, as soon as I get off the plane in Dublin, like there's just a guy who walks up to me with a pint glass and invites me into his home for dinner. I mean, and then they, by the end of the night, I am their next son. Does that kind of, I mean, it,
well, you will get a taxi driver from the airport that like won't stop talking to you like he's known you forever. Like right. That's true. Right. You know, so you'll get some of that. But right. I don't think you should depend on
the kindness of strangers
taken in immediately. But there is a lot of that. I mean, you really can. Yeah, you can depend on the kindness of strangers here, actually. Although right. Irish people would deny it probably up and down. You can, you know.
They deny it? Why would they deny that? That's
a- Well, there's like there's a really weird tension here of like you have to get it just right. You can't romanticize Ireland too much or they dislike it. And right. You also can't diss on it too much or they dislike it. So it has to be this kind of like celebratory woe, you know, celebratory like loathing, which is great. I mean, it's fine. You know, I mean, I don't tell them secretly that I love almost everything about it. That's not true. I do tell them that, but they seem to be okay with it. I mean, the main, the number one question, you know, like when I tell them I moved here from LA, they're like, what the fuck you want to do that for? You know, it's like, that's their main question. What the fuck would you want to do that for?
That was my question.
But then at the same time, they love it here so much, you know.
And you've gotten some media attention, right?
Yeah. It's gone really well. I mean, I had the first interview I did, I told them not to air because they were just idiots. Mm-hmm. I got interviewed by this radio station here called Today FM, and I won't say the host, but they just asked me the most basic, boring questions, and it was all about porn. And I told them, you know, like, I've done a lot of things. Can you just look into it? And they said, yes. They had a show researcher. And then I got there and it was just like, so what do your parents think about you doing porn? And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? You know, but then, so I told them not to air that. But then I got on this podcast that's live, recorded live often, with this guy, Blind Boy, who's in this kind of pranky band called the Rubber Bandits, and he also is an author. He writes fiction and he has this podcast, and he asked me on, and we did it live, and it was in front of like 1500 people, sold out, you know, this like huge venue here. And that was my first media appearance in Ireland, so it was awesome. It was just awesome. Me and him on stage for like 2 hours, you know.
Yeah, isn't that a blast?
It was great. Yeah.
I've done one live podcast in Brooklyn and it was like electric. It was so different. It's amazing. What a different, incredible experience. I want to do them all the time. I would do one like weekly, actually, if I could.
I hated doing the one I did though. That's funny. Like not his, but like my own. Cause I did one here with two people and I just hated it. Because it wasn't, but that was my fault because it wasn't my audience. It was part of a festival set up around my friend Peter Rollins, the theologian, philosopher, his work. And it was him and this guy Todd McGowan, the psychoanalytic theorist, both of whom had been on the show before, both of whom I'm friends with. Mm. But they didn't have to explain anything to the audience about their perspective, but they didn't know, their audience didn't know anything about what the fuck I was talking about. So it was like every step of the way I had to like explain or just really have kid gloves on. And I just really hated that experience.
Yeah.
So maybe if it were my own audience, it would be a little easier.
No, it would be amazing. You would love it. I mean, when it's your own audience, people have been mm-hmm. listening to you closely for a long time, that's who would come, right? This would be like very serious fans. This would be like the cream of the fans. So I highly recommend it. You and I talked about doing this in LA, right?
Yeah. We never ended up doing any of that stuff.
Because you fucking left. Connor, my mommy left me when I was five. And then you up and leave, and you didn't even discuss it with me before. You just announced it. You just came to me and said, you're leaving. And there I was, all alone in LA.
Yeah. Deal with it, bitch. Hey. Sorry, I'm just saying what your mom said, too.
Fucking gays are mean. Why are you saying?
we prefer the term sassy.
All right. I've been telling you about Paloma Verde CBD, this company out of San Antonio, Texas, for several months now, how I use their products every day, and how now it's scores, maybe even 100 unregistered listeners now are also customers because of the benefits they're getting from Paloma Verde. But let me just cut to the chase here. You've probably either bought CBD in the past or you're going to buy it in the future, and they're just giving you the best deal. And also they happen to have many of the values that unregistered listeners tend to have. So go to PalomaVerdeStore.com, plug in the discount code Renegade. Some people are forgetting to do this, by the way. Carlos just told me that many of their unregistered combo packs, which are my three favorite things packaged together, many people have been buying those without using a discount code. Use the discount code so that I get the credit. That's what this is all about, people. Go there, get that discount code, and you get 25% off anything in the store. If you're a first-time user, if you haven't joined their mailing list, just join their mailing list. You get another 10% off. That's 35% off your first order. The combo pack, which I just mentioned, is my tincture. They have a high-potency tincture in that. The soft gels And I don't have the gummies to show you because I just ate them all and threw them away. I forgot, but that's included as well. You end up getting a 33% discount on the unregistered combo pack, otherwise known as the Thad Pack. Go to palomaverdestore.com, use the discount code Renegade, and make your life better. Thank you. Thank you. So listen to this. So you've been on my show, what, two times?
Yeah.
And I've been,
on mine once.
Once. Okay. And I, am I right, have never asked you about your porn career.
Is that true?
That is true. Pretty sure.
Wow. That's crazy. Well, is that true?
Well, put it this way. Can you recall any parts of our conversations that were about your porn career? I can't.
No, I can't actually. I mean, I think maybe we talked about sexuality and maybe how that flowed into porn, but not really.
No, it wasn't even a minor topic of discussion.
It's really funny.
The only thing close to it is I teased you a bit, I think it was on the show, about your Twitter account, maybe.
Probably.
Maybe.
Definitely possible.
But that wasn't even, yeah, that's different than your porn career. So I don't know. Obviously you're averse to talking about it, which is fine. And I've clearly not been eager to talk about it, but
I'm not averse to talking about it at all, but I'm not a porn performer right now. So, you know, right. I wouldn't say ever again, but right now I'm not. So it's not like,
yeah, you're not, that's not what you're doing now. You're doing something else that's really different and very, just as intense and just as meaningful, or maybe more so. So like, it's a little weird to go back into your former career when you're like, and you've been doing this for a while now. You didn't just like, you're not like a porn star last week and you just decided to have a podcast. You really have been shifting to public intellectual over
three years now, I think.
Yeah. Well, before then, because I knew about you before then.
Well, I was doing sex worker activism and writing that kind of stuff and giving talks around the country. And now I was doing online classes and stuff, but the podcast is just 3 years old now. A bit, just like right around 3 years old now. Yeah.
But no, you were a public intellectual before then. I mean, you're amazing. Was that, where were those? Oh, those essays, those amazing essays that I love so much, the memoir stuff. Those are published before then?
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. I was writing and everything, but I think people would still tend to think like, that's the porn star writer, you know, which is irritating, but also it's true, you know, but now I'm not really doing it. I think people are just like, that's the podcast guy, you know, like, or if they think that, yeah.
I think you're right. Yeah. I think your public identity has changed. I've noticed that. Yeah. I think there's less reference to you as that.
Which I wouldn't mind, but I think people are afraid to actually assemble the two as what I am, or as, you know, like bring together the fact that people could have done many things. It's like people really want to discuss the one thing that they, you know, feel comfortable saying you do.
Yeah. I mean, what, you know, okay, let me try this reframing or framing, you know, like, it just hit me that, you know, I was thinking back in your career as you were talking, like the whole multiple careers in your life, basically, as much as I know of it. I mean, you probably, as much as anyone, maybe more than anyone, is the like walking embodiment of a refutation of the Western mind-body duality idea, right? Mm. Because it's not just that you're very intellectual and very sexual, it's that you intertwine them and they're co-constitutive, as we say, and you know, your sexuality informs your intellectual work and your intellectual work informs your sexuality, it seems like, and it's all in a good postmodern way, just this kind of intertwining thing. Mm-hmm. And there's no conflict in you. That's one of the things that's great about you, is that the way you, at least you talk about it, and you've talked about this incessantly ever since I've known you, you know, about your sex life. And you talk about it with absolutely no shame whatsoever. You are the most shameless person in America when it comes to sex. That's
funny.
And Ireland too now. So you're an international star.
Well, definitely Ireland I am. That's for sure.
Yeah.
There's a lot of shame here.
Catholicism but, there, yeah.
I mean, that's funny. That's how I met John Ronson, because he...
Oh, really?
Because he was writing that book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed. And he reached out to me and he's like, you seem like you're someone who feels no shame. Can I like talk to you about this? And I was like, sure.
Yeah.
And then we became friends after that.
But, that's funny. Have you heard his... I think brilliant podcast about Pornhub.
Yeah, the butterfly effect is really, really good. And so good. In fact, a lot of porn performers I know, and including me, we cried when we heard it because he's the only person that really has managed to get it right. I mean, part of that, and he would be fine with me saying this, I put so much time helping him into helping him with that. And I mean, he said it publicly in like different like lectures and presentations he's given and stuff. And of course, there were lots of other performers that helped him. But initially, I was really one of the, you know, people he talked to a lot about that project. So, you know, he was consulting and talking to people to try to get it right, which is also just very rare. You know,
I didn't know that. That's awesome. That makes me like it even more. Well, it also makes it also, I understand better why it's so good. It's a very, it's definitely one of the very, very best podcasts I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's great.
It's yeah, I've been telling people about it for more than a year now, ever since I listened to it. But, so yeah, I had some, I mean, there are, don't you think there are moments in it when he kind of betrays a little bit of anti-sex, anti-porn?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
In himself.
He has a whole, he has a whole thing that he, I don't know if it's in that one or the Last Days of August, which is not quite as good, although it's still good, but where he attributes like men, like young men not being able to get erections to like porn use and stuff like that, increased porn use. And, you know, I mean, I told him afterward, cause I didn't know that that was going to be in there. And I was like, John, that's just that's just bullshit. You know, I was like, there's lots of studies of that, but also I mean, you can just check into the algorithmic decline in testosterone levels over the past 50 years. It's crazy. So we could just, there are lots of places to go if you want to stay purely physical, but there are also lots of cultural things that we can look at. And
I just saw that. I just saw that decline in testosterone. I don't know. What is that? Tell me, help me. What's going on?
Yeah, interesting. It's an interesting question. I mean, my boyfriend's an age management doctor, so that's how I heard about it, you know, and he just has, he was just like, we don't know what's going on, but like one of the big problems is that when you get tested for testosterone now, they test you based on the average. So they don't look at like what people had 50 years ago. They base it on like what the general public has right now. And so all their ideas of what normal testosterone levels are actually extremely low. You know, and I mean, my best bet would just be all the fucking industrial agriculture, medical waste, like that kind of stuff. You know, I mean, I would say that that's probably it. Like the quality of food has been really terrible since, you know, pre-World War II. It's just really been declining. So I would probably say that, and plus water and, you know, quality and all that.
I'm going to make a guess, even though I know nothing about the biological science. And you, what, do you have a master's in it, right? But
I, no, I have a certificate, but yeah, same thing, basically.
You essentially have a master's in biology. I have nothing in biology, but my guess, and this might not even hold water, but I just have a feeling this is it. And it's I'm blaming capitalism, but just in a different way, for something else. And it's making us sedentary. The sedentary nature. And I have a feeling that once the body is at rest all day long for year after year after year, the body's going to say, hey man, you don't need testosterone. And it's going to start, you know, limiting the supply. I mean, that, I don't know if that's a thing. I just made that shit up right there, but you know, but you know what, you know who else has made up a lot of shit? Scientists.
Scientists, totally.
that's my hypothesis, you know. Go test it, guys. Like, I don't know. What do you think about that?
I think it's good. I think also I'm wondering then about like radio and microwaves and that kind of stuff as well, because that's definitely increased. I mean, you just have to look at the things that have changed over the past 50 years or whatever drastically, and you can see it. And so the sedentary thing is one.
I just occurred to me. Here's an even heavier, more crazy,
do it,
Alex Jones kind of hot take here. You ready?
Good. Yes.
But I think now, but let's, I want everyone to listen to me with an open mind right now. Okay. Everybody open your heart.
Does anybody listen to you with a closed mind? Well, like everyone, that would be.
Yeah, that would be weird. Well, yes. And they stop listening to me. So I want the heart to open first, and then I want the mind to open for this. Okay. Is everyone ready? Okay, good.
That's the best way to manipulate somebody. Just open your heart as you listen to me.
Hey, I'm running a cult. I'm running a cult here. I don't know what you're doing, Connor, but that's the new that's the new business model for podcasters.
It's true.
It is. Of course it is. So, the testosterone decline began when?
Well, I'm fudging that number. I'm saying 50 years ago, but yeah. it's something like that.
Yeah.
You know? I mean,
yeah, it's yeah. around 50 years old. You know what else is 50 years old?
What?
Second wave feminism.
Oh, there so, you go.
Come on, man. Like we had a sea change in our culture. This was right. This was, I mean, some feminists now will claim we still live in 1950s patriarchy handmaid still, but they are obviously insane. You know, there was a sea change in this culture around gender and all that stuff from the 50s to now. I mean, a sea change in all sorts of ways. This, we don't have to get into this, but this seems indisputable. So, you know, men are in the workforce way less. Women are in the workforce way more. Women have much more money, more power. And in fact, now I think most of the couples I know, heterosexual couples I know, the woman is the primary breadwinner. Okay. They make up a majority of college students, yada, yada, yada.
But women have testosterone too. This is the flaw in your theory, because women's testosterone levels, I think, are also declining. So
is that true?
Oh yeah. So people who are, you know, biologically assigned, you know, women, cisgender women, all that, like they're, you know, because I don't know that we'd have data on trans people from 50 years ago or whatever, not good data. So yeah. So everybody's testosterone level is actually declining, but what I will do is after the show, because we've spent so much time talking about something, that I'm giving you a number, which I think is correct. I'm going to go actually, I'm going to ask my boyfriend for the specific data. And I don't know, do you do show notes?
Yes.
Okay. I'll send it to you and you can put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
And if it's wrong, I'll just go in and change the PDF. Like to match what we were saying.
Yeah, just doctor it. Just doctor it. Yeah.
Exactly.
I want to even exaggerate it a little bit to make me look even smarter. Thanks.
Let's just say coronavirus caused it 50 years ago.
No, I don't want anything blamed on coronavirus. God damn it, man. I want to get out of this prison. Thank you very much. I think people who wear masks all alone outdoors should be run over by cars.
I it's really, really weird wearing a mask when you're walking down the street. Wearing masks in their cars when they're driving by themselves is completely bizarre. Wearing masks in your Twitter avi, like all that kind of stuff. It's all very strange. Wearing masks in your selfies. I don't get it.
You must hate it. I mean, as a sexual person also, like it is so anti-sexual. It's so puritanical.
Totally.
I mean, it's a fact.
And people are trying to eroticize it, and it's just not. It's not working.
Gross. Yeah. Masks are gross to me. They are anti-sex. There's nothing sexy about smelling my breath. You know, like I don't get that.
And
you see people's faces, and then the social isolation, which is, yeah, they don't talk about this social isolation, which is that I can't see your mouth when you're talking. So it's much harder to have a real conversation, which means we don't really converse.
100%.
It's just the forms of isolation are, you know, there's multiple levels of them, multiple forms. We're not even taking into account all of it, but we are all lonelier in a big way now, in all kinds of ways, you know, almost all of us, even those of us who are lucky enough to have like family and friends who we quarantined with. Right. But I've talked in person, like had a real conversation with three people in the last 4 months.
Are you serious? That's a lot of isolation. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen people, of course. I go to the store and I see hundreds of people, but in terms of talking in person, one-on-one, yeah, it's been my girlfriend and her family. And that's it for 4 months. Cause we were the only, cause we quarantined together at the beginning. So we knew we were okay. And that was it. But, so you like it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I mean, you know, I'm not asking anybody else to like it, but for me, it's had a really clarifying effect. It's allowed me, I mean, it was very obvious that people's rhythms were being seized, commodified, and destroyed by, you know, the way the world was running until it came slamming on the brakes and everything in the back seat flew forward to the front seat and everyone had to look at it, you know? But now So my rhythms were like that too. You know, even as someone who I moved here, I was rather happy. I was doing a lot of things I want, but my life felt completely schizoid. And this was like, all right, now I can wake up. I had to generate my own rhythms, basically. I had to do my own act of daily breathing. Like, these are the rhythms of inhalation and exhalation of the day for me. Mm-hmm. And that is really profound. And I know that, and I think that that's the task, you know, ahead of us for a lot of people, is deciding that we will generate our own rhythms. And I don't know that people are really taking up that lesson. But at least there is now an understanding for a lot of people of what that could look like. So it's the same thing, like, you know, Occupy, which people call a failure, but it was also a training ground for a lot of skills. And I think that this is going to prove to be a training ground for a lot of things that we learn that will be useful in the future and that will become necessitated by all the horrible shit that may or may not be ahead. I don't know.
Yeah. I like that way of putting it. I forget what you said, the verb you used, but was it instituting or creating our own rhythms?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. We have to, right. Cause the rhythms have been taken away from us. The structures have been taken away from us. And then self-care, you know, we all talk about this, right? It has become so urgent that is the primary fight that I have with my girlfriend right now, is about how much self-care I did today. Like, you know, and if it's not like yoga and meditation and two walks and calisthenics, it's not enough. And it's true, but it, you know, so it's like, it's forced her into the position of being a cop, and it's forced, and then it makes me feel like a criminal half the time, but it's right. I know that if I don't do that, I'm going to be goddamn miserable if I spend all day alone in a house or wherever. But it's, you know, that, I guess that's valuable to sort of gain those skills and to know that I can do that the day when they come for me and put me in solitary confinement, that I'd be prepared for it. Like the worst, hello everybody. The worst thing that you can do to Thad is put him in solitary confinement. I guarantee that. I'm not kidding, man. That's my worst nightmare. So basically I'm just developing a set of skills for that moment when the state comes and grabs me and puts me in solitary confinement. So I'll be in my cell in San Quentin meditating and doing yoga, and I'll be like, that's cool.
And just walking around the small space that you have as your daily walk.
Well, no.
Yeah.
No, here's the other thing I'm bringing. I'm bringing this idea, you know, that there is no objective reality. So I will be in my tiny, you know, bare 10-foot by 10-foot cell, but my mind will be able to go to Paris and visit you in Dublin and have sex with beautiful women. because my mind, of course, as you know, can go right through those walls in an instant, and it can fly across the ocean in an instant too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's something everybody should be teaching themselves too, is to make internal the things that that people are trying to sell to us as external devices. So, you know, if you can walk down the street, and I was just talking about this on an episode of my show that I just recorded with Phil Lagarde, this musician and like magic scholar who teaches it in Leeds. But, you know, it's like if you walk down the street and see a tree and you imagine fairies in the tree, they may or may not be there, quote unquote. But, you know, it's good for us to develop these skills. It's like, that's what Google Glass and like Pokemon and all that kind of stuff do, that like privilege the subnatural engagement with the world through an overlay of device mediation. But all that stuff is completely possible just by imagining it. And by doing that work, you create so much more possibility for your inner life that allows you to then exist in external circumstances, which might be pleasant or unpleasant, but they will be of your choosing, you know? Right. So I think that that's really important. So I know you're kind of making a joke and kind of serious at the same time about flying to Paris when you're in your cell, but that should be an option. You know, people should have that option, and not to just appease any bad condition or whatever, because that would be the Marxist critique of that. Like, well, you're just not trying to change the material conditions and blah, blah, blah. But rather because we want that choice, you know, it shouldn't be compulsive that you have to change the material condition. You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, everybody knows that my position on prisons.
Right.
I want most of them destroyed today, and I want all solitary confinement in the world forever banned. I think that is the worst punishment I just said this to Bridget Fetisi on the show last week. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's worse than any other form of punishment.
Unless you're a monk.
Well, but the monks are communal, though. They're in a community when they're doing that.
Well, sometimes, right?
They're not in solitary confinement.
Oh, yeah, that's true. But sometimes they are. Sometimes they spend that time, you know, or a hermit or a guru in the woods or whatever. But I guess there's more freedom of movement and all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
That's true, though. No, the isolation. Okay, I'm thinking of John Muir now, right? He like walked all over the Sierra Nevada by himself for like months and months and months. And yeah.
There were animals, though, you know, and plants and that sort of stuff. So correct. That's a little different, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so I am, but yes, I'm just getting at what the Marxists might say. Well, I'm not quite a prison abolitionist, but I'm pretty damn close, and I certainly want to abolish most of it. And solitary confinement, number one, because just for me, I'm telling you, I'm pretty sure I'd rather be burned alive. There's the leader of the Aryan, what's it called, the Aryan Nation,
in the Brotherhood,
Brotherhood, yeah. He has been, I think, for about 20 years now. He killed a prison guard. And the guard said publicly, they said, "We are going to give him the ultimate punishment," which was not execution. They could have asked for that, of course, because they killed a goddamn prison guard, right? No, the guard said this. No, we're going to put him in solitary confinement for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
So this guy, I think his name is, I think it's Tom Schneiderman, maybe. But anyway, you can look it up. He's in the Supermax in Colorado. And he's been in solitary confinement for decades. And when I found that out, I found that out like a year ago. And that has haunted me. Even though I'm sure the guy is not the nicest person in the world. It's just that experience.
You still don't torture him for decades. I mean, it doesn't matter.
Well, I'm just, you know, I can't imagine a more perfect torture for me. Like that's, if anyone out there listening hates me a lot, that's what you should do to me. That's the worst thing you can do. And that's, and I think we're experiencing all sort of a low grade form of that right now.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think the connection to the global events, you know, it's really interesting. It's like, you know, the change in space is that we're inside, but we can't stop feeling connected to others, you know? And so I think that the connectivity is really interesting. I don't think solitary confinement is that, you know, I think it's like like with touch, you know, when you touch people, you do this weird thing where you at once, establish, like if, you know, the boundary of your body. Like when I touch a table or I touch you or someone else, I'm saying, this is not me. Like I know that instantly. But also paradoxically, touch is the way in which we have an inner experience of togetherness with somebody, of warmth. Mm-hmm. So like the inverse of the boundary is what gives us a sense of connection. And so now it's really weird because we've taken away the ability to we've taken the ability to feel that warmth with people because people are stuffed inside still in many places, not here so much, but still in many places. Mm-hmm. But you've also taken away that boundary from other people. So I think in some ways people feel more connected than ever, even though you can't touch people, you know, even though you can't generate warmth with someone through touch.
Yeah. I mean, I've had tons and tons of incredible conversations over the last 4 months, you know, like this, you know, I see them and I can hear them and we talk for hours, and that's, you know, both with podcast guests and my son and friends and family and everybody. I've done a ton of talking, but it's still, I miss the touch.
but inwardly, I'm just saying inwardly, like what have you ever experienced a global event like this? Like none of us have. Like the entire planet is within us now, you know? I mean, it really is. The entire planet of human beings, at least, is within us now in a new way. And that's never happened before.
What do you mean within us?
Well, our inner lives are concerned with the entirety of the world.
Oh, okay.
Like even during a world war, it's like, well, sure, there's a world war in Ireland. I'm in a neutral country. Like they didn't, you know, there's a really great book of poetry, which I forget the name of, unfortunately, but it's about Ireland during World War II. And it's just, it's so lovely. It's about, you know, this neutral country, you know, while all this other stuff is going on and how you interpret.
I forget that they were neutral. That's amazing.
Yeah. Good move. And some of them liked Hitler because he was killing
the Brits. He was
attacking the Brits. Yeah, exactly.
Something they wish they could have done themselves with their petty, you know, with their silly Irish Air Force.
yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, but so like, but yeah, so I mean, it's just like, even then you didn't have an event that inwardly you were sensing that the entire world was going through something, that you were sensing, you know, what people were going through in Italy and China and Japan and wherever. So, you know, I think now that this is a pretty singular connectivity, you know?
Interesting. And that you kind of like that, sounds like.
Well, there's no choice but to like it, really. I mean, you could be miserable about it if you want, but it's not like I have a choice. Yeah. Feel free. Feel free to dislike it. But but also, you know, you just sort of run with what's given, you know, to you. And
I am not. Thomas Jefferson once said, this is the only thing he ever said that I like. he said that I am happy because I choose to be happy.
Yeah.
Which is just,
yeah.
And that's a Zen insight too. I wonder where he got it from, but you know.
So funny, because remember Jordan Peterson? First of all, remember Jordan Peterson? But Jordan Peterson, that was a big part of his argument, was that no one can make themselves be happy. And I was like, of course you can. What the fuck are you talking about? Like, people choose to be happy all the time.
Did he say that?
So, oh yeah.
No, I don't remember that.
And Zizek agreed with him, but
Sam Harris thinks.
But then destroyed him.
And Sam Harris thinks we have no choice at all over anything. So,
stupid.
No free will. You know about that, right? No free will. That's his thing.
Oh yeah, stupid. Those people are idiots.
Amazing. Well, look at what happened. Look what happened to poor Jordan Peterson. Oh my God, dude. We haven't talked about Michael Brooks.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about Michael Brooks, huh? 2 days later. That's when this is being recorded.
Glad
you
I
just had him on your show.
I've had him on. Yeah, I did. I had him on 2 weeks ago, and then he was on unregistered last summer.
The classes. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's a show. Yeah. Yeah, and he, we were talking Friday about stuff. He hit me up asking for some advice about some books and stuff, and we were talking. But he. Like when he was on my show, I mean, there's a bunch of stories I have to tell about this, which I'm gonna try to write an essay about it. But like, I went after him on his politics. I left him standing out in the rain because I was late. He had to wear my shirt during the interview, and he was cool with all of it. I was like, man, a lot of people by now would have been gone, and you know. He was drenched when he came in. I left him standing in the rain for like 20 minutes, and then he wore my t-shirt during the interview. And then I would tease him about it later, and he'd be like, man, that's an alpha move on your part. And I was like, you're probably right. and I haven't listened back to it, but my memory was like, I think I was a little bit condescending and a little bit like, you know, I was really like pushing, and I was, and kind of a couple times I was a little bit probably condescending, and he wasn't. I mean, you know, I didn't like his politics. I teased him about like the fact that after his revolution, he's going to have to send me to the gulag. And he was like, no, Thad, you don't have to participate in socialism and work. And I was like, Michael, yeah, no, that's what socialism is. So, you know, even though I really like you and you really like me and we're friends, unfortunately, after the revolution, I'm not going to work. So you're going to have to do something to me, won't you? So it's like I was getting in. I mean, I was really bringing all the weapons.
You're on it. Yeah.
Yeah, I was on it. I wasn't being mean or anything, but I was like totally going after him. And then, you know, and he, afterward, we just hung out. I gave him some edibles. and then he like texted me like a day later just to say like, oh, here's that thing I was talking about. And then 3 days later, like, how are you doing? And then I was like, wow, that's just the way this guy is. I don't think I'm special. He made me feel like he cared about me, but I also got the sense that he does this with a lot of people, which is really true from what I've heard. But then the thing that really got me was that right when the quarantine started, like the second or third day, we were the first people to lock down in the Bay Area in the world, I think. I mean, after Asia. Mm-hmm. And he texted me out of the blue just to see how I was doing. And I was like, at first I was like, that's weird. But like, I was like, damn, this guy's really genuine about his socialist politics.
I think that that's, sorry to interrupt. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think that that's the thing about Michael. It's like, you know, I actually, perhaps this is harsh, but in some ways he was a little bit of, he's kind of a mediocre pundit in a way. Mm-hmm. Like if he would say these things that were just sort of standard or repeating things that he heard somewhere else, but that wasn't like the content of what he said was not what made him special, and that you could miss that if you had only paid attention to the just kind of Young Turks kind of talking points that would, mm-hmm. or majority, you know, report or talking points that would come out of him. Yeah. But what was really special about him was, and you could feel it, even like he would say something you'd heard 100 times before, but it would sound different coming from him. Mm-hmm. So that's what I mean when I say mediocre. It's like someone else could have taken the content of what he said many times and actually it would have just felt a bit flat. But it was because it was woven through with mm-hmm. this real concern for people mm-hmm. and this real love for people. And I think it's something that actually, you know, in my arrogance, I think I missed, you know, like until, like I would see it sometimes, like when he would reach out and say this or that, like in the way you're talking about, every once in a while he would reach out and give me a compliment on something from out of the blue. And it'd be something very surprising.
Right.
You know, he asked me, I met him because he asked me to be on his show to talk about the occult and politics. And nobody wow. had done that really at that point.
Wow.
I was like, you have like a leftist show, like this yeah. is really strange. Yeah. And he was like, yeah, but I really like what you're doing. And of course I didn't know at the time that he
really
had written this book on Buddhism with the, you know, Josh Summers or whatever, and that was a really big concern of his. And then we would talk about that back and forth a bit, spiritual, you know, spiritual angles of leftist politics. But he, you know, so you might have missed it, you know, if you just listened to the specific facts or perspectives, because it's like, well, yeah, we all hate Sam Harris, we all hate Dave Rubin, we all, you know what I mean, like these sorts of things. It was his presence, and that I think is actually the most important thing. Like we have to, I think, more and more really pay attention not to what is said but who's saying it, you know, the general spirit of the person that's saying it is really important. And I think people finally started to get that just when he died. I think that there's a tremendous opportunity right now if people want to take that lesson yeah. that Michael embodied in his life in, yeah, you know, exactly. It'd be really profound.
That's what I want to say in the essay. Yeah. So I have, yeah, I, you know, first of all, I'm glad we're doing this now and not yesterday. I was crying for 24 hours pretty much about this, you know, I mean, if I had never met him, I would have cried. He was 37 years old. He was phenomenally productive. He was mm-hmm. clearly just, his career was on a rocket, you know, mm-hmm. and he mm-hmm. had his own show for 2 years, which was really successful. And you know, the Michael Brooks show, I've been telling people this, man, that show was like a graduate seminar every episode. It was just like being in a Columbia or NYU graduate seminar back in the day when I was there. I mean, they were doing heavy duty, in-depth left academic scholarship, basically. And he had like a huge audience and for that, I mean, especially for that. And it was really impressive. And it was like, wow, you can actually do like that kind of academic stuff and people want to watch and you can actually make a living. So I love, and he was very serious minded on his own show. He really was, he did tons of research. He knew politics up and down and he knew world leaders and stuff. On the Sam Seder Majority Report show, man, I really dislike Sam Seder. And I dislike Mike on that show because they, as Eric Weinstein said, I think correctly, they relied on ridicule as a crutch. Mm-hmm. And even though, because Michael, this is one of the things I took him to task for, was like our mutual hatred of Sam Harris. And it's like, yes, we are completely on the same page about Sam Harris. But what Michael does on the show a lot is just imitate his voice.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what I mean when I say there's like a sort of a mediocre punditry. Like he was put in that place. And there was definitely depth beyond that in Michael, yeah. which you're right, came out on his own show when he did decide, especially talk about international.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, an international alliance, you know, or international activism. So, you could see it there. But again, even that, I think, was the result of a presentation of scholarly research to an audience who hadn't done any. So that can be very impressive sometimes when it's not really, but I was increasingly moved by his, by the amount of the spiritual sort of meaning laden, value based work that he was doing in the past year, especially. Yeah. So when he, you know, I think the Cornel West thing really got into him, you know, where he was like, here's Cornel West who has all the same political values, basically, but there's something else about Cornel West that matters. And it's this way of talking, this way of viewing, this way of speaking, this way of seeing, this way of inspiring and connecting. And I think that was really, again, as that started to open up, it really started to become something very special. And in fact, he had recorded something just before his death about why we need to investigate consciousness as part of, you know, like leftist projects. And I mean, that I would have loved to see where that went, but,
I know,
you know, it's up to us, you know, it's up to us to do that now, you know.
That's a great point. And I think that's exactly right. I think he was going there. So a lot of people don't know that he had a whole other career leading meditation retreats.
Yeah.
And I was essentially, I guess, a practicing Buddhist, and was deep into that his whole life. And I am positive that that is a major reason why, you know, he reached out to me the day of the quarantine to ask how I was. And that's the reason why he connected to you in similar ways, and why, like, now we see like hundreds of people talking about how that's how Michael was with them. And yeah, man, I've said that if the left were full of Michael Brooks, I may very well be a leader of the Socialist Workers Party right now. You know, even though, I mean, yeah. and he certainly was not lacking in toughness and even some meanness, you know, his ridicule, I think, was really bad. Like, I think it actually, that's a contradiction. I think he would appreciate me saying this. You know, there was a contradiction in his career, I thought. But the fact that once he got his own show, he got really serious and stopped doing the ridiculing, told me that that's really what he's more interested in, and that he was really interested in like getting over identity politics and cancel culture and listening to each other. So like, even though I went hammer and tong against his hammer and sickle, he still just wanted to be friends and talk and learn from me.
Yeah.
And vice versa.
Yeah.
Great. Beautiful.
That's what I said. You know, I just reposted, you know, we recorded an episode of my show last year, and I just reposted it, you know, because I was going to post a new episode, but he had just died the day before I was about to post this new episode. So I reposted that and did a new intro. And that was something I said in that intro, which was, you know, there was plenty we disagreed in the talk, which I don't really do that on my show. I actually don't really get into disagreement with people because I find it unproductive and boring for the most part. But
what did you disagree about?
Because I'm always right. Well, you know, I mean, he's socialist, you know, and like as a social, like socialism has value to me, but not as the be all end all of like what we need to do to bring about or sustain after, much less a revolution. And he also, you know, I made the statement that Marxism is actually a rights discourse, not an economics discourse, which he disagreed with. And I was like, but that's what's good about Marxists. It's like that the rights part is actually good, you know. And we sort of got into a little bit of a, but it was never, all that happened, and this is what I said, is like, was we just took an interest in each other, you know. Like I took an interest in what he's saying, he took an interest, and there was no debate. You know, it was just like, I like you, I trust you, and I trust that I should listen to you, you know, and I felt the same way. And so we had a really amazing conversation, even around those points that maybe we didn't settle on.
That's it, man. That's why we have good podcasts. What can I tell you? That's what we do. It's true. It's true. You and I do that. You know, we have on people of many varieties. I know you do, and I certainly do. And I've never once had a fight on my show. And I don't think you've ever had a fight on your show, much, and barely an argument. I've barely had an argument on my show. And it's because what you just said, that you and I listen and take into account what the other person is saying. And that is our first job. Like to me, that's how I see it, is to really like hear you as well as I can and understand you before I make any judgments whatsoever. It's like, okay, here's this, you know, and it's someone from another, some political ideology that's totally not mine. I treat them like in a way like an animal at the zoo, some exotic thing. It's like, wow, that's weird, but I'm so fascinated by it at the same time, right? I've had people on with just the craziest politics you can imagine. And it just each time I'm like, there's this whole fascinating structure that you've built, you know, and let's examine the architecture together. You know, what's the foundation made of? What are the primary texts that you use to establish this ideology? You know, how does it all fit together? Is it coherent? Is it logically coherent? What are the political implications of this idea? You know, I just find it all fascinating, whether it's fascism or Marxism or socialism or libertarianism. Like these are like immense clocks that have been, right, that have been built, and that they work as a machine. Like it's this coherent system that's unified and integrated. And in most cases, it's kind of a beautiful thing, even if it's fascism, you know, just as a, it is like from the, as an apparatus, you know.
All right, Leni Riefenstahl. Yeah.
The engineering is, you know, it's like looking at a, look, you know, me on war, but like, I get it. Like there is something majestic about, you know, battleships, you know, I mean, I get it. When Brian Williams said that thing about the missile, you know, launching into the sky towards Syria about, what was it? I forget. He quoted Leonard Cohen and said,
yeah. I forgot what it was too, but yeah.
Love of phallic missiles or something. But anyway, but I get it. Like I was like, yeah, I mean, I wish you hadn't said that, Brian, but in a way I see it, you know? So anyway, I want to talk about your academic work.
Okay.
And I want to talk about the occult.
Okay.
Finally. Let's do it for real.
All right. Let's do it for real.
So you've been back at being a professional academic for now two and a half years, right?
One and a half. Yeah. But half, yeah. Sorry, apologies to myself and to others for rejoining academia, but
porn. And then you went back to, you did academic work in biology at UMass and then porn in San Francisco for many years and LA. Right. Mm-hmm. And then it was the shift into public intellectual. Right. And now it's back to academia while maintaining your public intellectual presence, right? Did I sum it up correctly?
Yeah. Well, and maybe we can talk about it later because we're talking about this now, but also I'm a novelist now, but that's a whole different can of worms. That is correct. And the shift to academia was, you know, I had a specific project and interest that I want to do, and I really want to live here in Ireland, and so I just brought those two things together.
And so what is your project? What's your academic project? What are you working on?
So I haven't actually gotten into the real research yet because I've done preliminary stuff, but I'm going to be investigating supernatural encounters in Ireland. People who have or investigate supernatural entities and what happens when they have those encounters, how it affects their material conditions. But I think more importantly to me, increasingly important to me, is how it affects their theories about reality, their understanding of reality, what people are, how the world works, ontologies, basically, how they form that, and why some people go some way and some people go the other. So, you know, that could be anything from, you know, there's a house not too far from where I live that is said to be haunted that people have been trying to sell for years and they can't. You know, it could be that. Or it could be someone who has been, you know, pathologized for seeing fairies, or it, you know, which however many years ago would have been permissible here. It could be someone who says they've been raped by a ghost. What do we do about Me Too when you don't believe that the assailant exists and you're supposed to believe the victims? And what does that tell you about subjectivity and individuality and all that kind of stuff? So it's all that. So it's all those things, but you know, it'll probably be like one or two of those things wherever the people lead me, because I'm really talking with and spending time with people and doing, you know, lots of field work and all that kind of stuff. Although that's all on pause now, of course, because of the difficulty of being around other people, but that'll happen, you know, eventually.
So you've done interviews with people?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not allowed to submit them into anything I do because I haven't gotten my ethics review board, you know, done. But a lot of the conversations I've had with taxi drivers, just with people around town, I mean, they've been really fascinating, really interesting, the things that people have experienced and what they make of them. You know, there's a guy who went on vacation and was talking about having, like, he was on vacation with his family and like something kept tearing the blanket off of him at night. And then like one day he was like, you know, he didn't tell anybody about it. And then his friend went to the same vacation house and was like, you know, it was so weird. My daughter was talking to somebody and I thought my wife was up there, but I went upstairs and he was like, who are you talking to? She said, the man, didn't you see him? And they were in the same place and those two people knew each other. So they talked to each other and, you know, had shared that information. And, you know, when you ask someone like that, well, what do you think it is? You know, what do you think happened? To me, that's where it gets interesting because it's like, well, how do you fit this in? You know, or did it have a shattering effect? Like for a lot of people, it has a real shattering effect when something like that happens. Mm-hmm. Or but then sometimes people just completely compartmentalize it. They're just like, yeah, that was that weird thing. You know, life goes on.
Yeah.
And that's interesting as well.
Huh. And oh gosh. Okay. So my father subscribe to the Skeptical Inquirer. Do you remember? Do you know that what that was?
Sure.
Yeah. So it was this magazine that came out. I don't know if it was. I guess it was monthly. I know in the 60s and 70s and 80s. And he loved that magazine. And he was so the Skeptical Inquirer. What it did was it just debunked UFOs, Bigfoot's theories, and then also anything that was paranormal, right? So like the stuff you're talking about. So my father, and he was a computer scientist, by the way. He was a coder. Yeah, I think this is all fits together. He if he had heard this, what you just said, he'd be like, yeah, well, that's a bunch of bunk. And the question is, you know, which medication to put them on, not, you know, whether to examine their beliefs about what has happened. I am not there. That is not me. But I am somewhere between him and you, and I might be closer to you now. And I think I feel like I'm getting closer and closer to you on this, but let me ask you, maybe not. I don't know where you are now. I have a really educated guess, but tell us, like, where do you, when you hear,
okay,
someone,
well,
like when you hear someone say they've been raped by a ghost, what do you think of it?
Well, you know, obviously it's different in every case, you know, I mean, it's a case by case basis. The rape thing is really interesting because I think one of the reasons why people are so frustrated by the conversation about sexual assault in general, much less by ghosts, is because we know and understand that sexual assault is a subjective crime, that violation takes place in, you know, the sort of context of the victim's life, and that you can't quite understand what that violation might mean to somebody. So someone could say, someone grabbed my ass at a bar, they sexually assaulted me. And people can be like, fuck you, that's not sexual assault. But that could be the worst thing that's ever happened to that person. Mm. Or someone could be violently raped. Or it could be the opposite. I know people who have been what is very clearly, you know, very physical rape. And they're just like, yeah, whatever. It was like, it sucked, but I got over it. Wow. So I think it's really vexing because it has the subjective element to it. And so then people go on these proof finding missions for it. So I think, you know, with the, you know, raped by a supernatural entity thing, which there have been plenty of cases of that over time, and certainly alien abductions, but I'm not really getting into aliens. You know, it's like, it has a similar aspect to it where it's like the assaulter is also relegated to subjective experience. So what that means to me is that the things that are extremely challenging to us are definitions of reality and deeply felt relations to ontology, what is real, that are based on individual experience are completely threatening to everything that we have in place right now. And I think that that's one of the really interesting things about Me Too that nobody's really talking about, right? But it also, you know, and it's also what Freud really essentially said. I mean, people get Freud wrong all the time. They say that his theory was that everybody had been abused as a kid, but then he took that all back when he got older and did more work and said, but no, actually, like, they're just sort of imagining it. And people like Moira Donegan and some other people who just have no idea what they're talking about say these things like, well, that's the beginning of not believing in victims. But actually, what Freud was saying was the opposite, which is so profound, which is like, whether you find the proof of it or not, these people were deeply affected by an experience, and it needs to be reckoned with. And that experience is, it merges in a cultural context, which for Freud was basically a phallocracy, like all the hysteria, all that kind of stuff that people say is misogynist. Actually, he was saying, no, this is like, these are diseases that are caused by patriarchy. So, you know, if we take seriously the claims and understand that healing needs to start, and these discussions need to start from the deeply felt experience that relates to the claims and the symptoms, then we have a different definition of what's happening in reality. And I think that's really profound.
Yeah. I might have told you this. It's certainly something I would have told you. I don't know if I did though. So I knew a woman who was a lifelong therapist in mental hospitals that were for schizophrenics. So she worked with schizophrenics for years and years and years. And at the time I had a great deal of disrespect for her because she was essentially my mother-in-law. And she did not treat me very well, but she told me that she believed what the schizophrenic said, that the people that they were talking to were real, and that the spirits and ghosts and animals in their heads were real. And she treated them. And I said, oh my God, this is just confirmation that Susie is a fucking batshit loon, and I want to have nothing to do with her. This was 10 years ago. I now have very different ideas about that. Especially now that I'm fully Foucauldian and have imbibed deeply from his critique of the asylum, especially, and the way that we society has categorized and shunned and then caged people who are deemed to be schizophrenic, who simply hear voices. Well, guess what? I heard a voice this morning. You know, I heard a voice last night in my head. I heard 50 voices. Mm-hmm. I heard your voice and Hotep Jesus's voice. And I heard, Jay-Z's voice too, because I was listening to his, you know, I mean, and they're speaking to me, and I'm hearing voices from my past. I'm hearing people I've known in the past. I'm hearing them talk to me from 10 years ago, 20 years ago. I'm hearing voices from the future. I'm imagining people saying things bad to me in the future. Well, what if, and there are moments when I get so wrapped up, and maybe I'm exhausted or something, and I get so wrapped up in that, right? The anxiety, I get consumed by it. I can't get out of it. I'm ruminating over it. I'm ruminating over this voice in my head about this person who said something in 1995. Well, is that not real? I can guarantee you my life is fucked up in a real way because of it. It doesn't, you know, yeah. So.
Anyway. Totally. Yeah, no, it's really well said. I mean, I think, you know, Lacanian psychoanalysis was one of the first that, you know, Western, you know, psychoanalytic traditions that said, you know, when you have a patient who is psychotic, like, you have to affirm what they've gone through and accept it. Because there's no way, like, you'll make things so much worse if you try to sort of cure them out of it. And then Deleuze and Guattari, you know, they went much further even with it in schizoanalysis. But I think it's like the idea being that, you know, our ideas of what reality are based on, you know, an imagined authority. And so psychotics in psychoanalysis, or at least Lacanian psychoanalysis, they are said to not have this thing which is called the name of the father, meaning in a very simple, this is very reductionist, but like, you don't accept that there's an imagined authority at all. That in fact, you just don't have that, and you've never had it. And so you're either aware of this or not, defined the conditions for yourself, kind of in the ways that we were talking about before with solitary confinement, you know. And it's something that I say, and I think maybe Deleuze and Guattari, but not Lacan, would agree with, is like one of the tasks that we have to do is make people psychotic. That's actually probably the best political project that we could have, which is reaffirming the ability to be the person who defines reality, but in a way that makes sense. So there, there are bad ways to do it, and there are good ways to do it. And I'm certainly not romanticizing schizophrenia. And I think mostly what happens is people get led down a path that leads them to something that's much closer to, you know, the non-option of being schizophrenic. But actually, if we could plan our own psychoses, we would be in a really good place. And that, you know, I mean, to talk about the occult, that's actually what I think the occult does, is it creates, it allows you to create a psychotic diagnosis for yourself.
Oh. and it sounds like, is this the word curate it? Curate your psychotic experience?
Yeah, that's good. I like that.
To make it the most, you know, whatever you want, productive or pleasurable or useful, right?
Yeah, and I like that the word cure is in there as well. So yeah, that's good.
Yeah. That's what it sounds like. That's what the occult does, huh?
But, well, I hope so. I mean, that's what I say to people, you know, I'm like, look, it's either making me totally crazy or in a way that it makes other people crazy in a very similar way, or it's true, but either way, it's made me a better person. So I'm okay, you know, with it.
Yeah. But before that, you said something that was amazing. You said we need to become psychotic, right? Mm-hmm. I like that. So let's define psychotic, because this is important, right? We're leaning on this term a lot here. So let's define it. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was defining it in terms of psychoanalysis, which I think is pretty good. You know, a pretty good definition, which is that I accept no assumed authority. Hmm. Right, so basically, it. It's like,
wait, that's anarchism. If you,
what's yes, but
that's awesome.
But it's real anarchism. I mean, anarchism.
I know. But think about
anarchism.
That.
Yes, exactly. It's an anarchy of the mind. You know,
yeah.
An anarchy of reality itself. Yeah.
That's amazing. I never thought of that. But you're right. There is no father. There's no father figure. There's no authority. Holy shit.
No gods. Anarchy. No masters. Right. Yeah. But you might make one. Right. Yeah. Or you might make two, or you might make 100.
Just like when the anarchists take over. That's what they do. Right.
Right. Yeah, right. Exactly.
look at Seattle recently.
But you want to do it consciously, not just sort of fall into the trap of reproducing the conditions which you struggled so hard to get out of, or actually secretly desired to be perpetually.
No, what you want to do is really what you do this. And when your comrades start to erect an autonomous zone and they have a security force with AK-47s, mm-hmm. then you continue to be psychotic with them.
Uh-huh.
So yes. So it's perpetual psychosis. Mm-hmm. Perpetual. Mm-hmm. Now, the dictionary definition of psychosis, not the dictionary, but the American psychological establishment will say psychosis is simply, it is a detachment from reality.
Right.
So they make a totally essentialist scientistic claim. They assume that there is such a thing as reality and that exists, and that you know our job is to get people as close to it as possible with their minds. Our job as psychologists is to align people's minds with reality that we determined to be real.
Right. Exactly.
Did I exaggerate that at all? No. that's the American psychological establishment's goal, is to get our minds aligned with the reality that they deem to be the most real.
Right. So the psychologists can be the masters. Right.
Ding dong. Right. Yeah, of course. Right. and so the people with the biggest problems are the people they call psychotics. And they are the ones who are most detached from the pre-assigned reality of psychologists. Mm-hmm. The psychologists say they know what's real. You know, like back in the day, they knew that women were, you know, biologically inclined to neurasthenia, and they knew that black people were incapable of ever being president of the United States, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, and the gays were, all kinds of things, pathological and mentally
pederasts.
No, worse, like mentally ill.
Oh, man.
In various ways. That's why they put the psychotics, that's why they put the people farthest from their own pre-assigned reality in this category of psychotic, and then put them away or leave them on the streets. And what you and I are now saying, and I'm saying this because I just learned this from you, and I think it's awesome and it's very exciting, is that we should treat them as, what do you call it? Psychological anarchists.
Anarchists of the mind. Well, I mean...
Oh yeah, anarchists of the mind. There's I love that.
But see, there's a difference. I mean, I just want to make clear, someone who's schizophrenic, who's diagnosed as schizophrenic, is probably having a lot of difficulties in their lives in one way or another.
Oh yeah.
So it's not coupled with this, I don't want to say privilege, but it's not coupled with this like act or gesture of intention, which is what I'm talking about. And so it's a bit different, you know? And I think I don't want to say, oh, well, the schizophrenic, like that's the thing that people used to do. Like perhaps the schizophrenics are the mystics of their time. Well, maybe. And in some cases, I'm sure they were, but a lot of times people who are schizophrenic or have, you know, real mental challenges, they need help. But they need help so they can choose. Yeah. I know you're saying that. I'm saying that for the listeners. So
yeah. No, I'm not saying this is why we should look to them as the great intellectuals, you know, and we shouldn't take policy prescriptions from schizophrenics on the street in Skid Row in LA.
Right.
I'm simply saying that we should see that these people, like my renegades in my book, that they're very much like this, right? They are simply living outside the norms of the American psychological establishment.
Right. Yes, totally.
And that's why they were caged, and now that's why they are left in the forest by themselves.
And the law. I mean, also importantly, the law. They're generally living outside. I mean, you know, schizophrenic. Yes. You imagine someone walking around naked, screaming at night, you know, like drawing on surfaces that aren't supposed to be drawn on, you know, all this kind of stuff. So they're violating law, you know, whether it's actual political law or cultural law or whatever.
Yeah. They're being illegal almost all the time because they're loitering, they're doing all kinds of stuff. Right.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. I love that. That's really good. So it's not, it's like with the people in my book, it's like, I don't even know what the prostitutes of the 19th century thought about politics. I have no idea. I have no idea what the mafia thought about politics in the 1920s. I have no idea really what the drag queens at Stonewall like had in terms of politics, you know, other than getting the cops out of their bar. Like it's the fact, but none of that shit matters to me. It's simply the way that they lived. And they did it without shame. Now, schizophrenics, of course, do it without shame because they're unaware. But, you know, I do think it's very important to like, that's really, I love that. Anarchists of the mind. I'm gonna carry that around with me because we have a lot of homeless people here. And so I see them a lot. I will look at them differently.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we need to... as anarchists, if you are indeed an anarchist, dear people listening, like we need to do all the upending and overturning, you know, and that definitely aims itself at science, definitely aims itself at, you know, all these structures. And so, I mean, I think it's an interesting time now. We saw really quickly as this global crisis developed, who really meant it, you know, who really meant the things that they said, because so many people just disappeared into, you know, either just completely vacuous statements of, you know, what, like that they were, you know, it was just like so fucking horrible for them. And they just didn't like it. No offense to you, but also, and that was their main commentary. Or, you know, like just sort of bowing down to the state immediately and saying that anybody that didn't was crazy, accepting the lines from experts immediately, and anybody who doesn't is like anti-science and crazy and horrible. You know, all that kind of stuff. You saw that happen very quickly, and I think, you know, you just see who means it. And that calls into question, like, okay, so what things are we accepting? What assumptions are we accepting? What, you know, structures and hierarchies are we sort of letting in and just giving a pass to, because for whatever reason it's convenient or we're scared or whatever it is. So,
okay. All right.
Yeah.
Just for the record, I want everyone to know, yes, if you read my Twitter, you will think I'm a terrible person who wants to kill your grandmother. But I want, for the record, I want everyone to know, and I actually said this on Twitter, I have many people in my life who are very, very close to me, who are in their 70s and they are vulnerable, and I protect the shit out of them. I will not go anywhere near them. I will wear a mask if I have to go near them. And I've done that religiously. I do that with strangers on the street. Yesterday, I saw an old man who was clearly very ill walking with his elderly wife down the street. I crossed the damn street to get 30 feet from them. And that's what should be done. But it's just, so we know that for the elderly and the ill, this thing is deadly, but for everyone else, it is clearly not. So anyway, that's why we should.
Some people it's not. I mean, most I know people. Somebody who's 90 years old, who had cancer and was in treatment for cancer and got coronavirus and is fine, you know? So it's very, I mean, I think, you know, to the extent that you carry out these activities, part of, you know, the regulatory activities, part of it is to tend to the social body and the social organism and understand people are really suffering from anxiety and suffering from fear and all that kind of stuff. And you can't just, whatever you would think of the virus itself, it's not really good to disregard that. You know, it's not good to disregard people's like terror. You know, and be like, well, fuck you. Yeah. You're afraid. Well, guess what? I'm taking the mask off. You know, that doesn't work. Whatever you think about it, you know?
I agree. It sure is hard. It's hard when they yell at me on the street though. But anyway, when people walking all alone outside don't have a mask on, they are not allowed to speak to me.
Well, you wouldn't see if they were or not, you know, anyway.
They're driving all by themselves with a mask on. They are not allowed to speak. And I think they should be disenfranchised, actually. But, no, really. Like, why would you let those people have any power over your life? Okay. You have 12 minutes to give me another lesson in the occult.
Now, 12 minutes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But that's just the way it is today. You knew we had a hard stop, Connor, I told you. So I'm trying to think. I mean, you've taught me a bit here and there. Not your fault. It's been my reluctance to go there. I'm trying to think. Like, I'm giving you another chance, you know, to seduce me. To seduce me. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the most important thing we can do now, and I think we can take this up from Michael Brooks as well, but is to re-infuse, I will say leftist, even though that's maybe not resonating with you, but leftist politics with occult and spiritual principles. It's obvious that the analysis, the materialistic analysis of culture as a foundation for resistance is an abysmal failure. It's not working. It's not speaking to people. It's not getting anyone anywhere. Mm. And it also creates schisms between Western, you know, people and so-called Western people and indigenous people, people in the global South, people who have religious lives, and no bridge is made available at all, except this just sort of like fake solidarity with people who you are actually presuming are stupid for having spiritual beliefs.
Well, there is an actual bridge. It was built by Peace Corps volunteers. That's it, right? There's no bridge to the spiritual life is what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, and I'm saying, like, if you're just some, you know, hardcore materialist Marxist, you can pretend all you want that you have some kind of solidarity with indigenous people in Australia, and maybe you do around certain material actions, but to the point where you are telling everybody that having religious and spiritual views is stupid, like, you're still talking about them. Mm-hmm. So would you not try to understand that, and also understand that perhaps that's where some of your failures tactically, strategically have been coming from, is just looking at material conditions. And that's, I mean, it's obviously why the right is successful, is because they appeal to values, enjoyment, meaning, and religion.
Jordan Peterson, right? This is what he rode to success.
Yeah.
Exactly
Totally. I mean, his version was completely stupid, but he knew that. He knew that that's what people were looking for, was meaning. Mm-hmm. And I think that the most enriching meaning can come from understanding very simple question, which requires a very complex answer, which is, what is the human being? And when you ask that question, really, you don't ask it in a half-assed, boring evolutionary psychology way or scientistic way. Well, we're descended from apes, and now we're this and now we're that. Of course, like, we can look at parts of history that relate to evolution, but to just simply talk about it that way is completely idiotic, because we still have to contend with consciousness, with our thoughts, with our imagination, and stop pretending that those are just whims. So when we ask the question, what is the human being, and we let our politics unfurl through the answering of that question,
nice,
that's where our politics should come from. And that's what the occult actually does. I mean, it gives answers that you might not agree with. And there are bad occultists. So, you know, there are definitely occultists who were Nazis and fascists. There are also occultists who are anti-slavery activists. There are occultists who rescued Jews from the Nazis, or who were killed and hung by the Nazis, who protested them. Mm. There are obviously people who you would not call occultists, but have magical and spiritual traditions in indigenous communities. There are all kinds of people, you know, I mean, the basic, you know, Rachel Carson and Gandhi were both influenced by theosophy and anthroposophy, two occult systems. So, I mean, you have tons. Helen Keller was an occultist.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you have, occultist socialist, you know, people are always like, no one talks about the fact that Helen Keller is a socialist. I'm like, you know what? They talk about even less, even though she wrote a fucking book about it called My Religion.
Wow.
So, you know, you have these people that have been greatly influenced, who are really profound, you know, leaders and people have changed the world. Leaders, maybe I don't like that word, but fine. They served it in their time, who have changed the world. Mm. And I think that it's really foolish and stupid to, and it is its own kind of occultism, you know, to reduce things down to a picture of material conditions. You know, if you look into people, institutions in power, they're using this shit. I mean, how dumb do you have to be to make fun of someone for trying to have a sincerely held spiritual view, and then at the same time make fun of Trump and world leaders touching a fucking glowing orb, and, you know, and invoking God when they get into office, and having, you know, and Kamala Harris's secret Masonic police force, and all these kinds of like bizarre things that, you know, are just public record. You don't have to search in conspiracy theory. You can go to mainstream publications and see these images. The Reagans, you know, consulting with psychics, you know, an eco-fascist wizard informing Vladimir Putin. I mean, it's like, these things are just out there for anybody to see. They're not buried. You don't have to do InfoWars. You don't have to do any of that. How stupid do you have to be to see those people accessing this stuff and then deny it also to the people that, you know, might be on the left that are trying to formulate and use these beliefs in their activism and their strategies?
Kamala Harris has a secret Masonic.
That's the one I'm always afraid to say, because I still have residence in California, and I'm just like, well, we don't want that to come back. And because, like, one of the guys was killed, like, after that all went public, one of the guys died under mysterious conditions.
I am a major Kamala hater, and I've never heard this before.
Oh, look it up. Look up Kamala Harris Masonic police force.
Oh my God. She's amazing. She's perfect. Okay. You have 5 minutes left. Convince us to become occultists. Basically, what you've laid out is that there have been a lot of occultists of various kinds, and some suck and some are great. But like,
yeah,
what should I take from it? How could it improve I want to be happy, Connor. I want to be happy. Can occultism give me happiness at all? Please.
I mean, it'll make you feel less lonely, you know, like in your, how about this? Like, you know, I experience the world as populated by spiritual beings. I mean, I experience that. So I'm not alone in my house. I mean, and you never are. And when you can actually sort of get into that experience, you will understand that there is a kind of cosmic connectivity that is present for you and accessible to you. And everything around you has a quality of it. You know, the occult is the It's funny because I just had someone on my show that said that this was how what he would call Christ. And I had previously called it the occult, and some psychoanalytic theorists say it's sex, but I will stick with my definition, which is the occult. The occult is the nothingness from which everything emerges. It's a kind of, it's an immateriality from which all material emerges. All materiality is populated by the workings of spiritual beings, and they find themselves tangling together into a heaviness that presents us with a reality that is that we encounter, especially in objects and plants and animals and thoughts and feelings and ideas themselves are the interactions of spiritual beings. Nothing is devoid of this livingness and or this beingness. And so first of all, that would make you feel less lonely, but also there are people who have worked very, very hard to understand how to interact with that and thereby change, affect, interact with, engage, understand reality and the self. It is the ultimate, fuck you to every form of authority that is not legitimate. Now, you might think that there are forms of authority that are, no forms of authority are legitimate, but the forces that create the plants, the beings that adhere to make your organs work and to gather together in the as a congregation in your in the address of yourself to speak, and thereby their voices become your thoughts. Those are okay authorities. Those are authorities that appear for you, for us, that we can interact with and engage with, and they're usually not bad. Mm. Well, there are some bad ones, but they're usually not bad. So is the ultimate anarchism, really? And I know that people would, I know that a lot of anarchists would hate it. There are some anarchists who have done very intense anti-occult work and writing. Really? And I don't know what to say to them. They can, they're not informed enough, you know? So
the way you describe it could be very similar to the way that I think about consciousness, what I call consciousness. So my consciousness is not just populated. It is overpopulated with people all the time. So I'm not alone in that way. There's, you can also shape your consciousness, right? You can make choices. You don't have to ruminate about such and such a person. You don't have to ruminate about something in the past. And it sounds like that's also in the occult. Maybe it gives you tools to steer this thing or navigate it or shape it deliberately.
Yeah. I mean, the occult is not like, it's not a uniform term. People would have their own ideas of it, but mostly when people talk about the occult, they define it by saying aspects of it, like tarot cards or people naked dancing in the woods around a fire or this or that. And what I mean by it is something more fundamental, which is the open secret of reality, which is that it is consciousness. That means something. A lot of postmodern writers and philosophers have actually written all about this without realizing it.
Right.
I mean, Deleuze writes all kinds of stuff that he thinks is original that Rudolf Steiner said before. Okay. Levinas.
Rudolf Steiner is the main guy here.
People will find that interesting. I'm sure some of your listeners will say, oh, he was fucked up and racist and all this, but that's just, people don't know what they're talking about. But, Levinas said a lot of stuff about the other that is very much in tune with occultism. Certainly, even like Hart and Negri, I would say Foucault as well, like looking at powers and principalities is basically what Foucault did, in a way that can mirror the occult. I mean, Agamben is explicitly, religious and theological. So I think there are all these people that can be just sort of looked at as expressing occult principles without necessarily knowing. And a lot of that also, you know, Walter Benjamin, it was also explicitly occult. And that's even right. people yeah. that we, even people that, you know, I know you dislike, but people like Adorno and Horkheimer, you know, their concept is, I think it's the social totality. I mean, that it has this occulty sort of flavor and dimension to it. And so even though he wrote a book that was explicitly Stars Down to Earth, which is just, he's like, all spirituality is bad because horoscopes suck. But but it, even
those
then,
guys sucked, man. They sucked. Adorno. Adorno.
I've grown to respect Adorno, actually, but I think he just, I view him like Zizek now, where I think he's like an incredible provocateur, but just his conclusions were false.
Horrible. Anyway.
But I did an episode with this guy, Brian O'Connor, on my show, who wrote a book called Idleness, which was a defense in some ways of being idle. And he also had written a book about Adorno. And you would think that those two things didn't go together. But when I read his book on Adorno and Idleness together, it all kind of made sense, and it made me like Adorno a bit more. So maybe listen to that episode and you'll appreciate Adorno more. I know, I was surprised too. I was surprised too.
you would not exist if Adorno had his way. That's obvious.
Yeah.
He was so hostile to pop culture, pleasure, sensuality, individualism, all this shit that you've been. Like, he would hate porn. He would hate your occultism. He would hate postmodernism. He would hate you, and your name would be Dave Smith or Dave Johnson.
You say that, but he also loved Walter Benjamin, who was for all interested in all that kind of stuff, and
you'd be a librarian. Okay, I'm done.
Then be okay.
Yeah,
you know, okay. I think Adorno was just really trying to create conditions that were so repressive that people would have no choice but to be promiscuous.
No thanks.
So and furtive. That's my defense. I don't know if that's right. true or not, but yeah.
All right. Well, I'm still like looking at it quizzically but sympathetically, because it's definitely amenable to a lot of my thinking. There's no doubt about that, right? There's definitely some overlap. And I'll keep thinking about it. What should I read? Give me a short piece to read.
Oh God!
Occult 101, Occult for Dummies.
They're unfortunately, there just isn't one. I mean,
really?
Okay. Yeah, you know what I would say? There's a book. Here's Occult Light, which is still really intense and profound.
Okay.
There's a book called Psychomagic by Alejandro Jodorowsky. I think people might enjoy that book because he has genuine occult encounters with this healer Paquita that he studies with in, I think, Chile. But then he says, you know, like, I can't really replicate what she does, but I do this other thing called psychomagic. And this is maybe what we can understand as people who live in this kind of analytic Western world that right. can't sort of wrap their minds around. But it takes a lot of training. And, you know, I'm more apt to tell you to read old Goethe texts. Goethe's really good for occultism, but he might not be called that, you know. There's also, this might surprise you, but there's a book called Genetics and the Manipulation of Life, which is a genetics book, but it's so profound that you would get a lot of occult stuff out of it. And also Coming into Being by William Irwin Thompson is really a great one as well.
Right.
So I would say those, I mean, those are books I've read years ago. So I'm in a much different place now, but I'm trying to think of things that people who listen to this show who would have some hesitation and need it grounded in a kind of reality that they might already understand and accept. So thereby they find the occult through critiques of what they've accept, I think would be the best.
I can tell you that actually I have found out lately that a lot of people who listen to the show would be totally sympathetic to this and would at least be curious. Yeah. People are,
well, that's why we need more fucking time to talk about it instead of talking about Mass and
I know,
what the fuck, fucking Michael Brooks took up all our time. Motherfucker Michael Brooks
goes and dies and fucks up our show. I mean, like, thanks Michael.
He loves that he did that.
I know. Michael would totally, that was his sense of humor too. He would totally love
it. Totally.
R.I.P. Michael, we love you. I miss you, Connor, and I want you to come home. But I guess this is your new home. Are you going to stay there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But you can come here.
I can't wait. I've always wanted to go to Ireland. I lived in London for a year, and I never went to Ireland. It's my one regret about that time. So I will fly, and we will hang out, and we'll do this in person, maybe, if they let us. I don't know.
You can fly. You can fly here now. I mean,
I know.
You'll be looked at askance by Irish people, but it's possible.
Yeah, they don't want me. But yeah, man, this has been wonderful seeing you. It's been a long time, and let's do more stuff. Let's talk more.
Yeah. All right. And totally. Let's learn
from you all the time. I follow you on Twitter, and it's always great. And we know the audience loves you. You've changed lives. You've made people change their careers and leave the government and leave the Border Patrol and all these things, man. I mean, it's great. So
thank you, man.
We need you.
Thank you.
The world needs you.
Thank you. It's really nice to be like in your orbit again, man. I appreciate it. Oh, thank you for asking me.
Oh, good. I love it. All right. I love you, Connor. You're the best.
Love you too.
Okay. Bye, buddy. This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To join the new Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com. To join the new Unregistered Underground, the supporting listeners group for the podcast, go to unregisteredunderground.com. Thanks for listening.